Accession number 32299, reel 3.
Thomas, reel 3. You were just mentioning off the tape about the flying with skis on the aircraft.
Yes.
Could you tell me about that again?
Well, yes, we used skis when we were going to go on a long-distance cross-country in case there was any forced landing envisaged. And, of course, if we had wheels on, there might be, and we landed trying to land in some remote spot, it would be very dangerous if everything was covered in snow, etc. So we used these ski-equipped aircraft. The problem with the ski-equipped aircraft was the fact that it needed a special technique for taxiing was the most difficult thing to do in a ski-equipped aircraft. Because with the wheels, you can either apply brakes, if you've got brakes, and differential braking to make you go from left to right, or you can use your rudder and put a blast of open up the throttle to make more airflow over the things, and you can twist around that way. And that's the technique you must use for ski-equipped aircraft, because you haven't got brakes on skis, so you've got no brakes at all. So to start to move from stationary, you give a blast of air to ease you forward. Once you've broken out of the ice, as it were, or the snow, and moving, you quickly come back on the power, and then using quick bursts of power and moving the pedals left or right, you can swing the aircraft one way or the other. And when you're pointing in the right direction, then you add a bit more and you taxi very carefully and gingerly, because you can easily slide into another aircraft or go off and hit a tree or whatever it happens to be. So it is a tricky business, and we weren't allowed. We didn't have enough time to master the art of taxiing. So that was it was nearly always done by the instructor just in case.
You mentioned as well earlier that you did some instrument flying.
Yes, that would be basic instrument flying. We only had basic instruments in these training aircraft, just in case so we could, by reference to the instruments, and we did manage to get into some sort of a bit of a cloud, we would know whether the wings were level or whether we were going up or down, and the rest of it. We learned how to read the instruments, which is a very necessary part of flying.
Is it easy at first to trust your instruments, or does your body say sometimes that the aeroplane is doing something else?
Your body can tell you all sorts of things, and very many people have been killed by not trusting their instruments. One of the very first things you learn is always trust your instruments. Now, I've got another story about that, but you wouldn't like to hear that one now, but it's way much later on. As my wife mentioned a short time ago, I'm not only a pilot, but after I'd been made a midshipman and I'd been flown in the Far East with off aircraft carriers and things, the Admiralty put out an Admiralty fleet order saying that from that time, in the immediate future, they were going to recruit pilots who would be non-commissioned pilots. And but some people who had the dual qualification of pilot and observer would be the commissioned pilots, and the rest of them would be either pure pilots or pure observers. Now, I was on the first experimental course of that, and I passed out. And instead of being my official title being, for instance, Lieutenant P, or Lieutenant O, standing for pilot observer, I was, with only a few of us, I was a Lieutenant F, which is flying. So I'm qualified as a pilot. Now, after I'd finished while I was doing my training to become a night fighter pilot, as an observer rather. First of all, we did a complete retraining, and it took some months, and we eventually got to the stage where we were where I had been allocated that I would be going to a night fighter squadron, and therefore we had to do a lot of night flying and night-in-night interceptions and all the rest of it. Now, one night, we were down here at Cold Rose in Cornwall on the flying Fireflies, and because I was an observer, as an observer at that time, I was put into the I was flying in the back seat. And we took off from St. Mirren, from Cold Rose, in the evening time, about 8 o'clock in the evening time. It was a dark night, and the cloud base was 1,500 feet, I remember that. And we started to climb up through the cloud so as we could get on with our exercise. And we break out at the top of the top of the cloud, and the stars are shining lovely in the sky, and everything is fine. But the pilot, my pilot, I've flown with him many times, thought that instead of coming out on top, that he'd somehow turned upside down, and the lights that he could see weren't the stars; they were the lights of fishing boats. So he violently put the bloody stick forward, which made him climb into it so violently that he toppled all his gyroscopic instruments. And there he was in cloud at night, totally convinced that he'd nearly crashed into the sea upside down, where I knew that we were up high, because I had a reading in the back seat. I could tell by looking at the altimeter, watching him climb up. So we were about 7,000 feet when he did it. But doing that, he toppled all his instruments. And then followed a series of violent maneuvers. And I thought, Christ, what the hell is this guy doing? One minute the aircraft would be shaking, and I saw the airspeed indicator reading about 90 knots or something. Well, I knew, Christ, we've got to be spinning any moment. And then the next minute we'd be in a dive, and we'd be up to 200 miles an hour or whatever, 200 knots or something, whatever it was. At any rate, I just kept on saying, Mac, what's the matter? No reply. I thought, Christ, the guy's died. So when I looked at the altimeter and it says 1,500 feet, just about, and the aircraft was shaking like crazy, which it does before a stall, I thought, this is it. And I jettisoned the canopy, dived over the side of the aircraft in the pitch blackness, and it couldn't see anything at all. And I started to drop, and I then thought, Christ, you better pull the ripcord. So I reached over and pulled the ripcord, and then the parachute went bang, and I was left dangling there, and I thought, God, I can't see anything. I don't know whether I'm over land or sea, or whether I'm over a church steeple with a spire sticking up, which caused me to close my legs straight away. And I was dangling, and suddenly there was a crashing and a banging. I was landing in a bloody tree, and I'd actually landed in a tree in the Helford River area of Cornwall. Lovely area. And then I thought, well, how high am I up this tree? It's because you can't see anything down below there. It was pitch black. It was slight rainfall, you know, like a day like today. At night time, you can't see what's below there. And I thought, well, I'd better be a bit careful about this. But right in front of me was a tree trunk. And this is where, when I was a boy, we spent an awful lot of time out climbing trees, as most boys do, actually. And I'd climbed dozens and dozens of trees, chopped a few dozen down. But climbing was a lovely. I thought, this is no problem at all. So I got holding the trunk carefully. I carefully took down. I could hear the river. I could hear a river trickling down below, so I knew I was near a river. And then eventually I reached ground, and that was it. And I walked down. I kept on walking down the river because I knew I would eventually get out. Thank you, Deirdre. To the end of it, and we saw some lights of a farmhouse in the distance, and I went and knocked on the door. It must have been about 10 o'clock at night time by this time, by the time all this had happened. And an old lady, they were probably about as younger than I am now, but they were probably in their 50s or 60s or something, rather, and they were living in the cottage there. And I knocked on the door. They must have been terrified, because it was a isolated cottage, to see this chap. Because we were all wearing, I was having my gear on. They wondered, what the hell's this? But at any rate, I explained who I was. And they said, oh yes, well, we've got a chap living in the village down below, a fellow called Jock Fraser, who happened to be the senior observer of the night fighter squadron that I was flying with. And they got hold of Jock, and I had a quick word with Jock, saying that I'd landed, I was all right, but I was stuck, didn't know where I was. He said, I know where you are. He said, I'll send an ambulance. So they sent an ambulance out for me, and they picked me up and took me back to Colrose. Now the pilot subsequently tells me that almost immediately after I'd bailed out, he actually managed to dive out of the cloud, and there in front of him was the brilliant lights of the runway at Colrose, and he was immediately able to get himself orientated properly, and he landed, and he didn't realise he'd gone then. Of course, he wondered where well everybody else did as well.
But that was just the point where he wasn't trusting his instruments.
He wasn't trusting his instruments, no. You know, he can't have been. He must have been not trusting his instruments. And it can happen. You must always trust your instruments. Because you can fly around and you can... Well, if you try driving a car or something or other, you can, if you keep your eyes closed, you can be sure, you can be to keep straight. You know, you think, oh, I'm doing well. But in actual fact, you're going off one way or the other.
And he got partly disorientated with his visual signs as well, hadn't
he? There were a fishing boat at night time, the lights can look like stars in the sky. If you're upside down, you can imagine it. But that's somehow he got the wrong idea, but he violently put the stick forward, of course. He was the right way up. He thought it was the wrong way up, and he'd come down, so he goes bing, and climbs back up again into the cloud. Immediately, all the instruments topple. And your gyro instruments are the main thing which keep you flying in the air safely. Even these days, even in spaceships, they all use gyroscopes and things. You can, if the gyro thing falls over, you can also recover using your primary instruments, which is basically your altimeter, your airspeed indicator, and a little turn and slip indicator, which is not gyro operated, but tells you whether you're sliding left or right. So you can do it. That's why it's very difficult, especially at night time, especially if you're just scourge yourself fartless. And he was, the guy was obviously in a sense of panic almost. So I went on to fly with him subsequently. He was my pilot, so I did go up with him. I trusted him.
When you were learning back in Canada, did you have to use a HUD during your instrument training to pull over so you couldn't see out of the cockpit?
It was very basic stuff there. You always either use a HUD or they thought they might do. I forget what they did for instrument training there. I rather think they just put a sort of a screen in front of you, like an old map or something, rather, or something over your head, so you couldn't see outside of the cockpit. It was basic stuff. Don't forget, we'd only got a few flying hours and very very basic stuff.
Did you do any night flying there?
No, not at that stage. No, not at that stage.
Would that be too complex? Almost?
We went on. This was an elementary flight, EFTS, number 13 EFTS at St. Eugene in Ontario. There were a number of these. It was all part and parcel of the Empire pilot training scheme, which was the thing where some people went to South Africa, some people went to Canada, some people went to America. In fact, when we split up from St. Vincent, half the course was designated to go to Pensacola, which was reputed to have a very good, and it was a very good training system with the United States Navy. The other half was sent to train with the Royal Canadian Air Force, which is the part I was, and that I don't know whether I mentioned this earlier on, but if it hadn't been for that split as well, I would have, because the Canadian course was shorter and more intensive than the Pensacola course. And so when I got my wings, the people I'd been with in St. Vincent were still halfway through their training, and the United States Navy and the British government put the clamp down on pilot training, and they just stopped training. And again, it would have been a totally different thing. So again, it's just pure joss. Luck plays a large part in one's life, you know, one way or the other. You either meet the right people at the right time or you don't.
So, you said there was a final examination at the end of... Yeah. Is it a chief flying officer?
Yeah, well, it's just as simple. He just gets in and he just puts you through your paces. I don't know how long this thing lasted here, grand total. Where are we? Cornell. They did have a little link trainer there. Look, see, I've showed you something wrong there.
Oh, so you used the link trainer?
There was a sort of a basic link trainer there, yeah.
How did that operate, the link trainer?
I don't know. I've just forgotten. But that was halfway through the course. It was cross-country to base. We did some cross-country work later on. A bit more link, more stuff there. So the last flight... This was the next thing. The last flight was... there's the 60-hour test by Flying Officer Henbest. That was my test. And then I had a few... This including night flying. We did a bit of night flying after that. And I'm not quite sure what these various figures are. But there was another couple of hours, and then we were off on the next stage of our training, which was to Kingston and Ontario.
With that night flying that you did, is that a very basic form of night flying? Is it literally just a circuit?
I really can't remember that flight in the Cornell. It's odd that, but it would be very basic.
Again, because of the stage that you're at with that elementary flying training.
Yeah, we'd only had about 60 hours flying altogether, and it was just to show us what it was all about. I only had the one flight there.
With the people who didn't get on with the course, were scrubbed from it. Were you aware of what happened to any of those chaps afterwards?
Not got a clue what happened, but they just disappeared, and that was it. No, nothing was heard. We couldn't afford to think about things like that. Even the guys who were lying in the waiting to be buried because the ground was so hard, you don't think about things like that. You just got to put up with it. And you.
What had happened in those accidents? Because I know you mentioned the chaps who'd been killed in the accidents, but what were those accidents?
I don't know, but it's very easy if you've... I very nearly had an accident because I started trying to do... This is the thing, you see, which I was eventually selected as a fighter pilot. It's the sort of thing that a fighter pilot would do rather than a potential bomber pilot. For instance, I tried to do some aerobatics before I'd been totally shown exactly what to do. And you've got to be a bit careful because you've got to know push the stick forward or backwards at the right time. And I tried it without... using my own common sense, and I ended up in a steep spiral with the aircraft at maximum speed. I could have easily dived into the bloody ground, but so something like that might have happened. I really can't say. Or they might have been spinning in or something, or practicing something rather than not fail to pull out.
Can there be a case sometimes of overconfidence then, once you've learnt to actually just master the flying of the aircraft?
You can be overconfident. Absolutely. You can also be accident prone. That's another thing, which is, for instance, when I had a pilot once in my squadron. This was a Scimitar pilot, and this was a frontline squadron. And he had trouble deck landing. And this was in a Scimitar. This was a supersonic aircraft. And I put him ashore. With my number two, with my senior pilot, to do a bit of practice at in Gibraltar. We were using the runway there, and he came up on the radio. I was away. I don't know where I was, but I'd left the senior pilot in charge. He was just doing it, and this chap came up in Gibraltar and said, with a message for the senior pilot to say that he had lost confidence in his ability to land the aircraft. Now, that's an interesting thing to say. to receive on the other end when you're on the ground, and this guy who was flying around is losing confidence in his ability to land the aircraft. And but Colin, it was left his name, he used to live over here. He died a few years ago. He was a nice chap. Colin Caspard, Colin leapt into the only other available aircraft there and roared off into the air and formated with him and talked him round the circuit carefully and did to land at Gibraltar safely. Told me all about it. He was immediately grounded by me, and he never flew again. He was sent back to England. He had to go back to England, and they investigated the business, and they found that all the time he'd been given the benefit of the doubt. He'd almost done it, but he'd done something silly, and he'd been given the benefit of the doubt all the way along the training. As a result of that, he'd nearly lost his life. He could have really lost an expensive aircraft, because he ended up on the deck in the aircraft with very top of the, very nearly, these aircraft cost millions of pounds, and toppling into the sea, a very, very difficult situation. Terence, he never flew again, and what happened to him, I just do not know.
But that's an element right from the start of his training, is it, that he was always kind of...
Always given the benefit of the doubt. Borderline, all the great thing is, if he's borderline, watch him. If he's borderline twice, well, that's, you know, it makes sense, because you're saving the guy's life. It's easy, you know, much better to do that and try a different occupation.
You moved on then to, was it the Standard Flying Training School?
The next one, yeah. This was a much more interesting thing, because by this time we could all fly. Then we were flying Harvard aircraft, and Harvard aircraft these days are still flying. There's still a few Harvards around the place. It's a lovely airplane, and this is where we started using the aircraft more. As there was a bit things like we did a lot of formation work and We ended up at and this was at Kingston in Ontario, which is right on the edge of the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence River. And it was a lovely area. And
had the weather changed at that time?
Oh, yes, the weather, we're getting on for late spring, and the weather was absolutely glorious. In fact, it gets to be bloody hot. That's the trouble with Canada. It's subarctic. Very, very cold in the wintertime, freezing ice. In the summertime, bloody hot. But there we are.
What was the contrast between flying, obviously, the Cornell that you'd learnt on as an elementary trainer?
Well, that was a small aircraft. That was a small aircraft, and the Harvard was much bigger aircraft, a much more powerful aircraft with a big radial engine, and altogether, I mean to say, they used Harvards in films to pretend they were Japanese fighters and things like that, and they looked like a Japanese fighter. But of course, they're still restricted. But you could do it. You could do anything with the Harvard. You could spin them, and you could go upwards. And I used to do upwards and slide backwards as well, and then they flip over on one way or the other, and you'd recover and whatnot.
So they were a much more rugged aircraft as well.
Yes, much stronger altogether, and much more like. They did have. You could fit guns to them, and you couldn't do that with the Cornell. It was a much smaller aircraft.
And did that power affect other things at all? Was it? Were there any vices that it had because it was a much more powerful aircraft, or?
I don't think it had very many vices at all. I think it was a bloody good training aircraft, in actual fact. Very, very good. And it still is. You can still go and have a flight in a Harvard. I don't know where they have them, but there's one or two flying around the air in some place in England.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you tried to do some aerobatics.
Oh, yes.
Unofficially. Did that become more part of this part?
Oh, no, the aerobatics certainly were started, yes, but you were supposed to wait until the instructor had told you what to do and you'd flown with him and done these loops and rolls. But there is a technique, you know, about doing aerobatics. Very, very easy to do. I spent my life doing them. I've got I've done a solo aerobatic thing at Farnborough Air Show, which is one of the biggest international air shows in the world. But you start off, and it's all part and parcel of learning to fly the aircraft properly, and it's great fun as well.
What are the types of aerobatics that you would do at that stage?
Well, you start off, generally speaking, you might start with a simple thing like follow the leader, which you do in the juniors, like a sort of a very junior thing. When he starts, you get behind him, and he goes down like this, and you go down with him, and then he does this, and you follow after him, and that's great fun if you've never done anything and you're just learning. It really is. It's a good thing. And it teaches you sort of the very basics of sort of aerial combat as well, where you're trying to follow the chap ahead in order to shoot him down. But is he in the way? Hey, Scruffy, come on, go on, bugger off, go over there. Come on, Scruffs, here. Let me just put him. Oh yes, it really is great. And then of course eventually you're doing this follow your leader sort of stuff, and then you're briefed on how to do rolls, because if you're doing a roll you just don't sort of fly straight and level and put the stick over and do that, because you'll almost certainly end up in a big dive going downwards. You've got to go up a little bit and then start to going off and go all the way around. And then same with loops as well, or rolls off the top.
How do you do a loop? What's the technique?
Well, you just dive down. You put the aircraft in a dive, and you select plenty of power, because you've got to take the dive and then start going up. And all the time you're going up, the aircraft is losing flying speed because you're going climbing up, and you go over the top. Like that. If you want to do a roll off the top, you just put the stick over and you just roll off, you just roll out. But if you're going all the way around, you let the nose drop, and you look backwards to make sure that your wings are level with the horizon backwards, and you come out of it, bingo. It's simple once you've done it. But you've got to be taught wisely, otherwise you can make the wrong. If you're doing the barrel roll, you normally start with, which means it's great big roll, and then there's the slow roll, which is a much more precise movement where you're doing it, where you're keeping them more or less at a level height, but you've got to put the nose up and keep like that, and then the barrel roll is easily all the way over. So all these formation aerobatics with barrel rolls, they're barrel rolls. You can't do formation aerobatics with a slow roll, because that's for an individual aircraft. But a big barrel. Remember when the RAF were using 21 Hunters to roll at Farnborough Air Show in 1957, they took a great big sweep. Lovely to see them going around. Absolutely superb. That's the time when we had the Red Seahawk team that I was showing you about, and the smoke which we developed.
So at that stage, that becomes a bigger part of that type of training, does it? This more handling the aircraft and to...
You're flying your aircraft. The ultimate is to use your aircraft as a war machine for dropping bombs or strafing helping the army or whatever it happens to be. And or air-to-air combat as well, and that's where you learn. That's the way you've got to learn how to use the aircraft in all shapes and sizes, and in all conditions.
So you've moved on from that. What am I doing with my hands? What am I doing with my feet? Type of thing. You know that, and now it's using it in that
as a weapon. And this place we went to, Kingston, Ontario. There was a lot of formation work, a lot of instrument flying and preliminary instrument flying, 45 arc tests and so on and so forth. And there also, just towards the end here, we went to a different place called Gananoque, which is only a very, very first... did you hear about Gananoque? And that's where the armament training was, and we actually fired a... Here we are. Commenced flying at the relief landing ground at Gananoque. And we were flying F1 and F2. These are all fighter combat units, where it's quarter attacks on other aircraft. And that sort of thing. That's what all these things are here.